Welcome to the Money Insights Podcast, where high income earners go to learn wealth building strategies that will take them from high income to high net worth.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode of the Money Insights Podcast, where we talk all things money and business. I'm your host, Christian Allen. With me on the other line, Rodney the Pod Zabriskie. Rod, what's up, my friend?
Hey, I'm feeling good today. I actually got out, did a little exercise this morning. It's been a little while. I played a little basketball.
I'm proud of you. That's good. You know me. I'm always up on the elliptical every morning, but like...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're up and done with the elliptical before I even think about waking up.
That's
usually,
probably true. I have an ugly sleep schedule, most people would probably say. Well, okay, so I go to sleep at like 8 and I wake up at like 1 or 2, maybe 3 if I sleep in. And then I go do my day. So yeah, that's kind of how I roll.
Yeah, yeah, and all of us slackers that wait till like this morning. I woke up at 5, but man, you were already probably done and having a shower by then.
I was ready to rock and roll, Rod. I had already recorded 3 podcast episodes. Okay, maybe not quite that, but yeah, I'm up bright and early today, Rod. We're going to talk about another of my lists. And I originally made
a
top 5 list, but then I decided I like it better at 10. Okay, so we're going to talk about 10 reasons not to hire a financial advisor. I should clarify that. Not to hire a traditional financial advisor. And like, I get the irony that exists inside of the statement, but hopefully as we go through it, it'll make a little bit more sense. Because really what I'm hoping we can do, Rod, is we can kind of... pull back the curtains and let our listeners see what this world of financial advisory looks like, at least enough so that they can know enough to be dangerous and make good decisions. So that's kind of my hope from this whole episode. I realize that it might come across as negative, but the truth is that while I've got 10 reasons to not hire traditional financial advisors, there are actually a handful of very good reasons why someone would do that. We're just not going to talk about those today. We're going to focus on...
And do you say irony because we people might group us with that? Is that the...
Yeah, that's the irony. Good point. So I think that people from the outside, like, is especially when we talk about having a wealth building firm, like just because that's a generic enough phrase that normally that gets lumped in with kind of the traditional advisors that focus more or exclusively in kind of that stocks, bonds, mutual fund investment world. Okay, so is that enough of a preface for what we're going to talk about?
Yeah, I think so. Let's go.
Let's do it. Before we get into the actual reasons, though, I want to create a little bit more context around how the financial advisory business works. And so there's really 4 ways or 4 types of financial advisors that exist out there. The first one is kind of your classic, existed from the beginning because of Wall Street. It's your stockbroker. It's what you think of the people who actually like trade. Oftentimes, like, you can trade on the trading floor. But more often than not, they're at companies around the country like Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, Edward Jones, Raymond James, those kind of places, where it's not that they don't do anything else outside of investments, but that's really their focus and specialty, and their training is going to be focused on that kind of thing as well. So the first one is our stockbroker. The second one we're going to talk about, Rod, and maybe I'll let you kind of review this version, since this is really more where we've played. And that is in the kind of life insurance-based planning.
Yeah, well, and as it relates specifically to where you talked about, like, the traditional financial advisor, there are a lot of life insurance agents out there who are also licensed to deal in stocks, bonds, mutual funds. And so they incorporate that and make it a part of their overall practice. So they might sit down with somebody, and yes, they're helping them with their life insurance, but they're also helping them with IRAs and brokerage accounts and other things like that where they're investing in these things.
Yeah, so that's where I started. But before you and I got connected, I started and focused primarily on that, the investment side. I wanted to build up a RIA, then that was always my intention, or at least for the first few years, until I realized that that stuff didn't actually work all that well. And then after I realized that, I made some pretty drastic changes in kind of the direction that I was going. But I think you nailed it, Rod. The primary point here is that a life insurance-based planner is going to have a life insurance background. In other words, because they're generally affiliated with an insurance company, let's say it's New York Life or Northwestern or something like that, while they'll do securities, their core training will be in the life insurance space. And I think that's kind of the core thing to remember. So if you're talking to a Northwestern agent, or if you're I'm picking on or making it sound like it's just those couple of companies, but the reality is that really every insurance company also has a broker-dealer associated with it. So most of the time, if you have someone associated with a life insurance company's broker-dealer, then they're probably going to be more educated and trained in the life insurance space. Okay, so...
And just to clarify, so you mentioned RIA, and I just wanted to spell that out. So registered investment advisor,
yes,
is somebody who deals in more than just the life insurance. They're then reaching across and doing these other things.
Yep, you got it. And we're going to get into this in this third section, because this is kind of where that registered investment advisory, or the I'm trying to think of the way to describe it. So when you have a registered investment advisory, and then you have investment advisor representatives, so IARs, who exist inside of an RIA. You can see kind of that was a tongue twister, right? So, yeah. but again, an IAR will work inside of that, and it's usually a representative of that registered investment advisory. Hopefully that makes some sense. Perfect. But generally, that side of it is going to be focused on back on the kind of security side. And so the third way that people get paid, or the third type of advisor, is what they call a fee-based advisor. And that just means that they can and oftentimes do charge fees for assets under management, or they might charge a fee to create a financial plan or something like that. And in that situation, they call them fee-based because they can still earn commissions, even though they might be initially focused on a fee-based model. They can implement the strategies and products and actually be the ones who are implementing and making money on it. So, and by the way, I should have created this context. The reason that I'm talking about this is because there's a conflict of interest, and we're going to get into this when we talk about that point on my list. But regardless of what scenario you fit in, or what type of advisor that someone's working with, there's always going to be a conflict of interest. And so that's why, like I said, there's a bunch of reasons to not work with a traditional financial advisor. But again, we're going to talk about the, at least maybe not today, but we're going to get into the reasons why you would consider hiring one as well, because there are viable reasons. Okay, Rod, the fourth one. Go ahead.
Sorry, on that fee-based, so you're talking about charging a fee, and it could be for creating the plan, like you said, but then even inside of that, they might have fees associated with the...
Yeah, good point.
You mentioned assets under management, but based on what they're managing for you, then they might say, hey, yes, you have other fees beyond me, but I am going to charge you X percentage of the overall portfolio value to manage it for you.
Yeah, that's right. So like, you know, and I won't get into the way that mutual funds are charged, but let's say it's a Class A share mutual fund, then you would still pay the cost of that Class A share, which is, you know, higher up front and supposedly lower over time. But anyway, the point is that, you know, like you said, that's really the way it works. Okay, so the fourth version is your fee only. And these are really like these are the people who literally can only charge fees. I say they can only charge fees. If they put themselves out as a fee only advisor, then, you know, that's really what they should be doing, is only charging a fee. And that just means that the actual implementation happens from somebody else. So in that situation, you would hire someone to create a plan for you, or they might charge a retainer or something like that. And as a in return for that retainer, they're going to give you they're going to give advice. They're not going to be able to actually sell products and make commissions. Okay, is that clear? Clear
and
as mud.
In your experience, do they usually bring someone in that they recommend, or do they?
Yeah, that's a
maybe add some level of guidance while the individual is out finding other people to plug in.
So regardless of what kind of advisor you work with, there exists some type of conflict of interest, if only because each advisor is going to have their own training, upbringing in the business, and the philosophy that they bring. So anyway, with that said, I think it's fair to say that fee-only advisors are likely or should be have the least conflict of interest. Yet I've seen, you know, some challenges that exist there, especially if they don't have key relationships, then you're kind of, you know, left wondering where you actually go to implement things. So it's kind of a mixed bag, but either way, hopefully that at least gives people, you know, a general idea of the different types that exist before we get into the actual list. Do you think we at least accomplished that, Rod?
Maybe on that last point, I would just point out you end up paying twice. So in other words, if you have for example, a fee-based
planner
who puts the plan together for you and implements, it can all be incorporated into one. And still, while you may pay twice there as well, on the fee only, you know you're going to pay twice.
Yeah.
You're going to pay for the plan, and then you're going to go and find
the underlying
or be directed to people who can help you to implement. And then you'll pay fees and commissions on that side as well.
Yeah, and that's a great point, because when you go, let's go back to the fee-based advisor for a minute. They generally feel like their model is the best. And by the way, everybody feels like their model is the best, right? But the fee-based model, they feel like it's the best because most often they'll let you choose, right? So let's just say theoretically they come in, you do some planning with them. Oftentimes they'll say, okay, well, if you're planning to implement, if you're going to implement and implement through us, then we can waive the fee and we'll take the other costs. So there's like there's a little bit of give and take no matter where you're at. But I think you made a good point in the sense that regardless of that advisor charging again that or if they're charging the fee, then there are likely going they're not likely there is going to be an additional charge that's in addition to the actual underlying investment.
Perfect.
Great point, right?
Yep.
Okay, Rod, now we're going to get into the 10 reasons why I would not hire a traditional financial advisor. Okay, so number one is this, and I'm going to let you take a stab at it first, and then I have some ideas. But number one is that the financial services industry as a whole is just like the Wild West. So Rod, what do you think of when you think of the Wild West?
Well, the Wild West was just a bunch of renegades running around doing whatever they wanted.
You nailed it. That's it.
Right.
That's the industry. You don't know what's happening, right? So there's like 10 different directions we could take this because when we talk about financial services, that could it's just such a broad comment that it could mean a variety of different industries, right? So I talked about four advisors kind of inside the financial planning industry, but that didn't even take into account advisors that exist in, you know, legal, tax, insurance, and all those other areas that could all be kind of considered in that financial services space. Banking is another example of that. But anyway, like you said, it really is the Wild West. Everybody's out there. There's cowboys out there. They're just shooting each other. May the best man win. That's kind of how it goes.
Yeah.
And the challenge is that the consumers are really the ones that, you know, get hurt by that. So again, we're going to,
cause it's the loudest, it's often the loudest voice that wins, right?
Yeah.
Not necessarily as much of what's truly best, for any specific individual. So
I think, you know, maybe we'll give a couple of thoughts of advice as we go through these as well. But when you're dealing with the industry, I just think it's important to have the context. And the only way to get it is to do a little bit of research, to do some due diligence, and make sure that regardless of what type of advisor you're looking for, you've done the appropriate amount of research to make sure you're getting what you want. Because there's a ton of, Rod, I haven't even talked about industry designations. There's about 83,000 mm-hmm. industry designations, and most people have no clue what they mean. So anyway, the focus really should be on experience, track record. Those types of things are always going to beat out kind of those other, you know, ancillary things that can pop up.
And that's probably true regardless of how you came to know about them, right? You could have been referred to them. It could be someone that you know and have known, but if you didn't know them in that context and you're just starting to work with them, you still need to ask the questions, understand, you know, who they are, what they do, what their background is, their track record.
Yeah, that's a really good thought. You're right, because it just reminds me of, you know, this recent experience I've had as I've been, you know, I recently moved into the house and we've been building out the basement and doing some pretty extensive landscaping. And I had some people that I really liked and trusted that gave me referrals to landscapers. Now, landscapers and actually, you know, they're probably pretty similar. Let's be real. Landscapers and financial advisors, they're both
all in the Wild West.
It's all part of the Wild West. But seriously, I had some really what I thought would be really good recommendations that just turned out to be a little bit ugly. Now, I still appreciate mm-hmm. the person who recommended them, right? But even though they were close friends, the actual recommendation kind of turned out to be not as good as I would have hoped. So I think that applies across the board, and certainly when you're looking for a financial advisor. Okay, Rod, take us into number two.
All right, so number two is a typical financial advisor will only touch a small piece of the pie. And maybe even just knowing that is helpful enough. So when we talked about a minute ago, you want to go in and learn about and understand the person. Well, understanding where they come from, even if they're offering a broad spectrum of products and services. But again, if they only come from their background is primarily in only one of those, you want to understand that and just realize that it's almost impossible to be an expert in all things. And so people become experts in a narrow piece of the pie. But you need more than that. Right. So just be clear with, you know, anybody you're working with as to where they're coming from and what their expertise is.
Yeah, that's a great point. And there is a place for generalists. However, most generalists still don't touch a large piece of the pie. So if you talk mm-hmm. about your traditional financial advisor world, you're talking about insurance and traditional investments. Well, there's this host of other, you know, pieces of a person's financial world. And so when I talk about, this point is really to suggest that it's not a good idea to hand over your money to someone that's going to be kind of like your financial quarterback. There's a place to have people, again, trusted advisors you can lean on. But I really believe that at the core, you have to care about your money more than anybody else does. And so you really mm-hmm. need to be the quarterback and make sure that you have the right people in place to make sure that the entire pie is being baked. Okay. Number three, Rod, and this is just scary bad these days, but it's there. The advice is incredibly outdated. I don't even know where to start with this, but we always talk about things like the 4% rule, but there's a whole host of buzzwords that the investment world has been saying for the last 50 years that people still use today. And what's scary about that is just we have this history of it not working, and yet we're still doing it again and again. So it's the old history, or it's the old definition of insanity. And that's kind of what I've seen. Like, we talk about all of these, you know, retirement stats I like to throw out. Well, mm-hmm. you would think, Rod, that because of the poor historical performance that we've come up with as a country when it comes to, you know, saving and preparing for retirement, you would think that we'd be able to come up with something a little bit different.
Yeah, well, and one of the things that shows up, again, in kind of scary ways is like Dave Ramsey So he has these kind of, like you said, buzzwords, these things that he keeps coming back to. You can get an average of 12% in the market. When he's actually suggesting people with a withdrawal rate when they get to retirement, would you believe that he says 8%?
I wouldn't believe that. Does he really say that?
On his website.
It's that's right there. Scary because like we talk about, most people, I just read something from Wade Fow, who's like a well-respected retirement income specialist.
Yeah.
And he was using the 3.35% number when I read the last article. So that looks a little bit more like what I've seen. So to even think that anybody's suggesting an 8% withdrawal rate's just kind of crazy, at least in that traditional world.
Yeah, for sure. And the reason I bring that up is because I think, well, he became big toward the end of the 90s.
Yeah, that's true.
And so if you look at, if you take that snapshot in time and you're looking back over the previous 10 plus years, it was amazing, was it not? 12%.
That's didn't true. Seem you were outlandish. Rolling. Like, seriously, you could throw a dart, find an investment, and earn a great return, no matter where you went. But that's not that different than today, to be real.
Anywhere, yeah. .coms, everything. So
okay, well, that's a good point, Rod. So to kind of dovetail on number three, where I said the advice is outdated, it's also incredibly ineffective. And that, again, just goes back to the proof is in the numbers. And my opinion on this is just that there's got to be a better way. There is a better way. And those are some of the things that we're going to talk about as we go on down the line. Okay, Rod, number five, we're making our way down the list. Number five, there is a massive, and massive maybe understating it, but there's a massive conflict of interest, and this exists no matter where you go in the industry. And this one, honestly, Rod, I don't really have a solution for, but maybe start by just kind of defining that conflict. I think everyone's going to know what a conflict of interest is, but just to be safe,
yeah.
Explain it.
Yeah, so the... Well, conflict of interest just basically means that when I'm making a decision and making a recommendation to a client, what I get paid becomes a major part of what I'm recommending and what they ultimately end up doing. And so...
Yeah, so the issue is that there's payment that takes place inside of any of these types of relationships. And just because of that fact alone, there exists a conflict of interest. And that just means that the advisor could be looking out for their own interest. And when we talk about specifically that conflict of interest, it just means that the two interests, the two parties' interests aren't necessarily aligned. And so that becomes even more difficult to trust because, you know, knowing that that's an issue. And, you know, just to be very honest, there's really, from what I've seen, no way around this issue. And so from a consumer standpoint, you have a way around it, Rod?
Aren't there some of those designations that carry with them a fiduciary responsibility?
Okay, yes. And some of those, I think I have one or two of them that carry a fiduciary responsibility. Yeah. So like, yeah, that is important, but I just laugh at those because at the end of the day, if someone's honest, they're honest. And if they're dishonest, they're dishonest, right? Like if I have letters behind my name that say that, you know, I'm a fiduciary, I don't know that that's enough to make me think, oh, okay, I'm in good shape now, right? So yeah, that's a scary one, but we hear it all the time.
Yeah, just to clarify, fiduciary just means that I have to put the client's needs ahead of my own as the advisor.
Yep.
And again, like you said, either the advisor does that or they don't. The letters by themselves don't necessarily.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That's a great point. Okay, Rod, we're cruising along now on number six. And I talked a little bit about this, but most advisors are tied to a company in one way or another. And it might be that they're tied to an investment company, a broker dealer. It could be that they're tied to an insurance company. Sometimes they're tied in some way to all of the above. And if I'm being honest, most advisors that you'll come across have some sort of connection either to insurance companies or investment companies. And therefore, there exists, again, this conflict of interest that we keep talking about. But anyway, that's so the thing you want to you have to be most concerned about is when you get to like the captive world where they can't even go outside of their kind of core stuff. So what I always tell people in that space is to make sure that you're working with someone that can and is willing to put the client's interest first, and when, if and when needed, go outside of their core stuff. And I also believe that if that's the case, then it's the responsibility of the advisor to make sure that the consumer is aware that they have that specific tie or financial incentive specific to a single company. Is that fair to say, Rod?
And it is fair. And an analogy that I heard that I thought was kind of interesting was often when, if you have someone like that who is captive to a single company, and so they have a group of products that they can offer, that it just by nature of what that is, just the circumstances, they're just carrying a hammer around and they're just trying to find a nail.
Yeah.
Right. So no matter what your need is, they're going to find a way to turn that into a nail because that they have the hammer that can solve that problem. Whereas if they are more independent, have and like you said, are willing and do reach out beyond a single company or a couple of companies to the broad spectrum of what's out there, then they have a full tool belt. So when they meet with you and you're expressing your needs, your goals, objectives, then they're pulling out the right tool for the right solution to what you're looking for.
Yeah, that is a good point. And I don't want to like harp on, you know, new advisors too much here, but it kind of also brought up the thought that it's one of the challenges that you run into similar to this with new advisors is that they may be like desperate to make money, right? And it's really a failure mm-hmm. of the industry, not necessarily a failure of the advisor, although they still have a responsibility to you know, put whatever financial difficulties they might be having behind them to do the right thing for mm-hmm. the client. But the challenge is that that's really hard to do, right? If you're a struggling yeah. new agent, how do you, you know, and you have a chance to make money, like put food on the table for your family. It just puts people in a really difficult spot. So I know that kind of goes back to number five, but inside of, you know, 5, 6 or 4, 5, and 6, like they're kind of all appendages of this conflict of interest that exists inside the industry.
Yeah. And along that same line, you have to have a certain amount of production with your primary company to keep the contract and stay with
good
them.
Point.
And so there are just a lot of different elements.
Yeah. And it's been a long time since we were directly connected or received more compensation from a specific company. So we work in a world where we can just go to whatever insurance company makes sense for the client. And that's just the way that we always do it. So there are some companies that we could use that would pay us more. There are companies we could use that would sometimes pay us less. We just kind of throw that out the window and focus exclusively on the actual performance for the client. And we hope, and there are a lot of, and I think that there, I was going to say that most, I don't know that that's true, but there are a lot of good advisors who do that
yeah.
for people.
Yep.
Okay, Rod, is that, let's see, where are we at? Are we at number eight?
Number seven.
Oh, I almost skipped it. Okay. So this one's important and kind of works through this too. It's along the same lines, but most advisors get paid regardless of whether you make money. Okay, so I'm going to hit on this first, and then you can take a stab at it, Rod. I think back, there was a company, I probably shouldn't say their name, but there was an investment company that made a positive impression on us probably a decade ago. And we were looking at, and it was specifically in the security side. They had a really interesting narrative. And the narrative was that, hey, because of that we're doing this fee-based model, our interests are very much aligned because as you earn money, I make money. But I kind of laugh at that because what they weren't saying is that, well, it doesn't, you still make money regardless. So in that case, what they'll normally do is they'll charge like a 1% or whatever, let's just say 1% for ease of math, but a 1% fee an assets under management fee is what they generally call it. And that just means that, let's say that I've got a $1 million portfolio, the advisor makes 1% of that, and that gives them their $10,000 a year of, you know, assets under management fees that they're making. Well, so what happens then is in that model, if obviously if your million goes to 2 million, then the advisor makes 1% of 2 million. And, you know, sometimes there's breaking points too, which can create efficiencies as you get higher account values. But the point here is really that it's 1% of whatever the balance is. And so if that portfolio goes down by 30 or 40 or whatever that number is, they're still earning 1%. And I think that's important. So most advisors, and really, I can't think of any advisors. I probably should put it this way. All advisors get paid in some way, regardless of whether you make money.
Yeah. And the idea is that they're incentivized by that percentage to, because they would rather make the 20,000 in your example than the
6,000
if it went down, you know, if they lost the 30-40%. But the point is well taken. You lost 30 or 40% in your portfolio.
And still paid for that performance.
You're still paying. You paid them less.
You do pay them less. That's fair.
You're still paying.
Okay. And again, whether you're fee based, whether you're fee only, like you said, it just exists. And so it again is part of the conflict of interest culture that as consumers, we have to all be conscientious of when we're making decisions about who to work with. Okay. Number eight, Rod, this one is, I kind of was going back and forth on whether to put this on here, and I'll explain why, but I said virtually all the information that traditional advisors give is just super easily accessible. So I do think that the average person could probably take a couple of hours, maybe that's not fair, maybe a week, of taking an hour or two a day and know nearly as much as, you know, probably 70 or 80% of the industry. That's kind of scary, but is that overstating it, Rod?
So one thing I think that people would be interested in is that your traditional financial advisor isn't staying up on all the different trends in the stocks or mutual funds or ETFs or whatever it is that they're that you're buying into. That person can't be meeting with people all day long and be the one that's making all the trades and doing all those things. And so I think what you're getting at is that, or maybe one element of it is that the advisor is giving advice and has to be smart, has to be educated in the way that they give that advice. And yet all they're doing is looking at the same kinds of trends and general information of things that would be available for any of us to get on, you know, do a quick Google search on XYZ, you know, mutual fund or stock or whatever, and could gather a lot of that same information.
So after being securities licensed for a decade, I kind of came to the realization that I didn't have any more specialization in investments related to the stock market than anybody else did. In fact, if there was somebody who was actively trading, now I could teach people, and I say teach, I could help people rebalance their portfolio and make sure it was diversified amongst a variety of different mutual funds and things like that. But to your point, Rod, we don't want to make the assumption that even if it's a stockbroker, right? Even if they're with Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, if it's somebody that's generally spending a lot of time meeting with clients, then they're likely not going to have significant expertise in the actual investments. Rather, what they'll be doing is giving you kind of, I hate to say this, but that kind of refurbished, outdated advice that people have been getting for the last 50 years that hasn't worked.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, so let's see. That's number eight. Let's go to number nine. Their most important role, from my perspective, is to help people manage their emotions. And so here's the question, Rod. Is that worth the price?
So let me bounce back what I hear you saying. So you're saying that I, as a consumer, as an investor, make decisions based on emotion. Mm-hmm. So for example, If I hear that a certain stock or industry mutual fund has been doing really well, then that would tempt me to want to go and buy that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
right. If it's not doing well,
the other direction. Oh, you're going there.
Yeah, if it's not doing well, then I would want to get out of it.
Yes. So the old adage, Rod, buy low, sell high, is the way that you make money inside investing, right?
Yeah.
So the biggest challenge, or the number one thing that gets in the way for people, is their actual emotions. So I do think that there is a value in making sure that you are checking your emotions, right? So I don't want to pretend that it's not an actual hurdle that people need to get over. It absolutely is a hurdle, and maybe the biggest hurdle. But again, my question is really not whether or not that's a valuable service. The question is it worth the 1 or 1.5% fee that I might be being charged to get that like emotional support? And I would suggest that there's other ways that you could get that besides paying somebody what's potentially significant amounts of money, especially over your lifetime. Now, again, I'm not against paying people money for doing great work. And we're going to get into that in number 10, because I 100% think that we should pay people for doing great work for us. I totally believe in that. And yet the challenge, again, just exists inside of the industry because of all of these points. So what ends up happening is a lot of these advisors are having to try and act more like therapists than actual financial advisors. So again, there's a place for it. I just don't think it's worth the cost.
And maybe as a recommendation, it's taking a step back and a realistic look at yourself and at least understanding how you react emotionally to these kinds of things. Because money, just generally speaking, is can be an emotionally charged thing for most people. And so if you see that in yourself and you understand how that impacts you, then when you are making that hire or when you are relying on others, you can at least be honest with yourself on what you're asking from them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great thought. Okay, Rod, so before we close it up, I've got to get to number 10, but I should say this. I've kind of alluded to it. Our intention is to do an episode that's focused on how to find your financial advisor or what things to look for. So this has kind of been your things to be aware of and go in eyes wide open. But we'll get into kind of a solutions methodology here. Okay, so with that said, Rod, I want to talk about number 10, which I think is the number one reason that you shouldn't hire a traditional financial advisor. And that's because there's a better way to do it. And the better way to do it is to do it through a team of qualified specialists that are all working together for your best interest. So we had a client on just the other day, this last episode, John Foley, and I thought he gave some really great advice as it relates to this. And maybe it was less advice and it was just his opinion on it, but he said specifically, I really like to work with subspecialists. That was his wording. And I thought that was interesting, right? So he's thinking, okay, if I have the choice of going to my general practitioner or I can find a specialist in the area that I need help, then why wouldn't I go to the specialist first? And I think that that's the way that people should be thinking as they're working toward, you know, finding an advisor. So rather than thinking, I've got to find a person who can do everything for me, you just have to have more ownership than that and say, I'm going to be the quarterback and I'm going to work through and find the specialist that can help me. Now, I do think that you could have some kind of core trusted advisors that you lean on more, and that's totally reasonable and acceptable, but just never take it so far that they're the ones kind of quarterbacking and doing it all.
I think human nature is that we want simplicity, which again is not a bad thing. But if that leads you to a place where you are asking too much of a single individual and expecting that they're going to be able or qualified to advise you in the broad spectrum of different things that you're interested in, then that's probably just a little bit too much to ask, right? And so recognizing that to the extent that you want to make more of your wealth building quest, then, you know, branching that out and asking, you know, asking experts each in their own field to advise you and work together to make all that happen would be the more efficient way, the way that's going to get you in a better position for all that.
Yeah, 100%. Creating a cohesive team working for your benefit is absolutely the best way to go. And we've seen it over and over and over. Our most dynamic wealth builders rely on team members to put together their expertise and deliver the solutions that they need and want to grow. Okay, Rod, that pretty well covers the 10 reasons why we think people should not hire a traditional financial advisor. And we'll be back to talk about how to build out your team here in the next few weeks. Okay, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Money Insights Podcast. To learn more about the financial and business strategies discussed in this show, visit moneyinsights.net.